This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. In 2012, Donald Trump called the Electoral College a disaster for our democracy. Now in 2016, many Democrats agree, given that their party, just like in 2000, lost the White House despite receiving more votes. And so movements to abolish the Electoral College have been revived. For example, California Senator Barbara Boxer has a new bill to get rid of the system through a constitutional amendment. But while this effort has almost no chance, there are other ideas to alter the Electoral College. Meanwhile, the system has its defenders who say a pure popular vote could have serious unintended consequences. Today in The Exchange, the Electoral College. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests. Joining us from D.C. is Lara Brown, Associate Professor and Interim Director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And Lara Brown, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Vermont, Christopher Pearson. He's a state senator-elect in Vermont. He's on the board of a group called National Popular Vote. That's a movement that we'll talk a little bit more about later, promoting an interstate agreement to award all electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the national popular vote. We will definitely dig into this, Christopher, but for now, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
And joining us also from Durham, Andy Smith, Associate Professor of Practice in Political Science at UNH, Director of the UNH Survey Center. And Andy, thank you for your time. As always, we appreciate it.
Great to be here.
So, Andy, why do we do it this way instead of through a popular vote?
Well, there are a couple reasons I think that are really clear to understand. First of all, the founders were very concerned about corruption in the chief executive, this being the most important office in the land, and that they were coming from a period not long before that where they overthrew what they thought was a dictator in King George by the Revolutionary War. So there were still great feelings among the people who wrote the Constitution that they did not want to have a strong executive, even though the experience of the Articles of Confederation made them understand the need for it. Therefore, they wanted to make sure that anybody who held that office was a very thoughtful, competent person who was not going to be politically corrupt. So that's the first thing. It was designed to reduce corruption by having each state appoint electors, meaning smart people or well-educated, thoughtful people in their states, to meet separately, not to meet together. So again, to reduce the possibility of collusion between the electors, and that they would choose cast their vote for somebody to be president. And then those votes would all be opened in D.C., in the Capitol, and then the person with a majority would become the president. So it was designed to reduce the influence of corruption, but secondly, it's based on the principles of federalism. So each state gets electors equal to the number of senators and representatives that they have. So it balances, it makes the states somewhat equal on population, but equal on, as the basis that they were independent sovereign states when joining when creating the country. So the same principles that make up representation in Congress and the Senate were in play.
So now, that's why New Hampshire has four electoral votes, right, Andy? We've got two members of Congress and two senators.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important that, again, it was designed to reduce the likelihood that public opinion or public frenzy would be the cause of choosing the president, and that would be this buffered system. And it was also assumed that, for the most part, that nobody would really get a majority in the Electoral College, and that the next step would be the most common or the most predictable step, and that would be that if no candidate gets a majority, then it goes to the House of Representatives, where each state votes as a state, has one vote as a state to choose the person among the ones with the top the top electoral vote.
Well, there's so much to dig into. But, Lara, on this issue of how these electors are given out, how much does this system give small states like New Hampshire, like Vermont, an unfair advantage because there is that, you know, automatic two state senator count no matter how big or small your state is?
Well, it does allow for the smaller states to essentially have a little bit more of a voice. I mean, when we think about the overall distribution of electoral votes, you know, there is obviously a big difference between California having 55 electoral votes, 53 of them owing to population and two owing to the Senate allocations, whereas New Hampshire only has four. So we still have a system that is like Congress in many ways, tilted toward essentially the population. But the states do have some weighted say, and they are important in this process. I mean, I think the best, you know, kind of analogy that's ever been put forward is to really think of the Electoral College as being more like the World Series. You have to win a lot of games. It doesn't matter the sort of number of runs you win in each game, or in other words, the number of votes you get in each state, so long as you win. But what you need are essentially a lot of states, and you need to win a lot of them.
Well, and I hear you on, you know, each less populated state has a little bit more of a voice because of that, you know, U.S. Senate count. But over the whole country, Lara, that starts to add up. I mean, Wyoming, you add up Wyoming's little extra weight and maybe New Hampshire's little extra weight and Rhode Island's little extra weight. And after a while, that's a lot of little extra weight from all these less populated states.
Yes, but it's highly unlikely that all of these less populated states are going to agree politically. So the other side of it is that we essentially have a system where both parties are able to, if you will, accrue support from some small states based upon their populations. I mean, Rhode Island is not very likely to be Republican, whereas Wyoming very much is.
Well, and Chris Pearson, I know you're not in love with this system. Again, you're a Vermont state senator-elect and also on the board of the National Popular Vote. I wonder what you think are the biggest problems with this system, Chris. I know you've got a lot of problems with it.
Yeah, well, the biggest problem, if I could only pick one, is that the campaign we just watched, and forget about the outcome and the divergent winner, which a lot of people are very frustrated with, the biggest problem is that two-thirds of that whole campaign took place in six states. And over 90% of the whole campaign, if you look at where the events were, where they spent ad money, was in 12 states. So we routinely have a system where 35 to 40 states are completely taken for granted. And I want to just disagree with something Lara said. She's right. If you look at small states and the basics of mathematics of how many constituents or residents equate to an elector, but she's not right if you're looking at political influence. You know, California with 55 electors is completely taken for granted, as is Vermont with three electors, as is our neighbor in New York with 29 electors. But you in New Hampshire with just four electors are the epicenter of the election because you're a battleground state and you could go red or you could go blue. And so the candidates come, they court you, they alter their positions to win your votes, and they are routinely not doing anything like that in 35-plus states, states that are big, states that are small. It doesn't matter the size of your population. It matters if you could go red or blue.
Well, and let's talk about that. And by the way, Chris, some people in New Hampshire would say you can have them in Vermont, but setting that aside for the moment,
right,
let's talk about that. And Andy, to you, you know, you do hear this. I mean, some people are feeling like my vote doesn't matter, despite what we tell our kids. If I'm a Republican in Massachusetts or a Democrat in Idaho, you know, my presidential vote doesn't really matter because all the electoral votes I know in Massachusetts are going to go to the Democrat. I know in, you know, Texas or Kansas, they're going to go to the Republican. So those people's presidential choices really don't matter. I'd love to hear from you on that, Andy.
It's true. It is true. But I think that the Electoral College isn't the cause for that, per se. It's parties that are the people that are really responsible for the fact that, these votes don't matter. Because when the Constitution was written, there's nothing in the Constitution at all about political parties. So therefore, the current system that we have, in which political parties have a much greater control than ever expected, is really driving a lot of this system. And it's also really important to remember that this was the Electoral College was seen as probably the least problematic of all of the aspects of the Constitution at the time. One quote that I love is that the mode of appointment of the Chief Magistrate of the United States is almost the only part of the system of any consequence which has escaped without severe censure or which has received the slightest mark of approbation, that if it is not perfect, it is at least excellent. So at the time, this was really thought of as a good system, but obviously over the last couple hundred years with the development of political parties and the having the political parties really involved in the complete infrastructure of American politics, the situation that we have where states, voters in states like Idaho or Vermont or you know, take your pick, really don't matter. So it's really the development of parties that has led to this.
That's interesting. Lara, what do you think? Don't blame the Electoral College. Blame the fact that we only have two major political parties.
Well, that's exactly right. And there are other aspects of the system that have very little to do with the Electoral College itself, but have everything to do with how the political parties took over the Electoral College and essentially gamed the system to favor their interests. So the biggest way that they do that, and the way that we most see it and usually ends up being the source of the greatest controversy, is actually the winner-take-all allocation of electors. That was actually done in the 1800 election, partly because basically Thomas Jefferson and John Adams each did not want the other to get electoral votes from each other's respective states. So what happened is that when a party essentially wins a state, the electors are then bound to essentially all go toward one winner or one ticket. That is an unusual decision, but it was one that made it easier for the two political parties to take more states off the table in terms of should they campaign there or not.
So let's be really clear on this, Lara, because I think a lot of people don't understand how these electoral votes are given out. So let's say you and I are competing in New Hampshire. You get 55%. I get 45%. So pretty close on my part.
Yep.
You get all four of New Hampshire's electoral votes.
Correct, because what happens is that in all of the states, with the exception of Maine and Nebraska, the state legislatures have determined that the awarding of electors should go to the winner of the popular vote of that state. So what that means is that each political party picks a slate of electors, and there are different methods for choosing those electors, but each state essentially has two different slates of electors prior to Election Day. And then whoever wins on Election Day, it is their electors who essentially become the Electoral College in their state and do the voting by the ballots that get sent to Congress.
So that's another advantage, Lara, for small states, right? This winner-take-all system. If winner-takes-all in California, then that's a lot of votes. But if winner-takes-all in all these other states, you know, the advantages keep piling up.
Well, what it really does do is exactly what sort of we were talking about earlier, is that it takes states off the table because you are no longer, if you will, competing for a vote percentage. Once you get past 50%, it's all yours. What it really would do if we changed around the allocation of those electoral votes is, say, if they were awarded proportionally, so going back to your example, say I were to get 55% of the electoral votes in New Hampshire and you were to get 45% of the electoral votes in New Hampshire, it would actually force the parties to campaign in more places because they would be searching for that one or two extra electoral vote that would come from winning, say, 60% as opposed to 51%.
Right. And it really does seem unfair to a particular candidate. You know, if it's 49 to 51 and the 51 gets all the electoral votes when the other person only lost by, you know, 2 percentage points. Chris, would this make you feel better about the Electoral College if all the votes were given out proportionally based on how well a person did in the state?
Well, it's never going to happen because if you suddenly swept the country with this proportional idea, the remaining winner-take-all state is only going to get more and more power. So they're never going to do that. You know, the winner-take-all rule, I agree with, I think it was Lara who said this, is the problem. And a lot of people think, well, the Electoral College is this red-blue map. But the red-blue map is, in fact, the winner-take-all system being adopted by every state. And in the very first presidential election, 3 states used the winner-take-all rule. They all repealed it. And for about 30 or 40 years at the beginning of our country, states were playing, using electors differently. They were trying all sorts of different things to make their own electors work for their state's benefit. That's very appropriate. That's what I think the founders intended when they handed New Hampshire 4 electors and Vermont 3 electors. That basically said, here, you have some electors, make them work for you. It's pretty hard to argue that now every state using the winner-take-all system, or except for Maine and Nebraska, every state uses the winner-take-all system. It's not working well for the great majority of states for the reasons we've been saying. I mean, in Idaho, as an example, they use winner-take-all. They have 4 electors. The Republicans run up a 400,000-vote margin in Idaho. It does them no good. You know, you might see a Democrat winning another state by 50,000 votes, and they get all of the electors there. So with winner-take-all, what you have is a foregone conclusion in a great majority of the states, which are shutting the people out. You don't see candidates campaign, they don't poll us, they don't visit, they don't run ads, there's no grassroots activity. Here in Vermont, we're a good example. If I want to get involved in a presidential election, I get in my car and I come visit you in New Hampshire and knock on doors. That does not make sense. And it is very damaging for people's faith in the democratic process, and it's very damaging for down-ballot races and voter participation and on and on and on. And there's also, frankly, benefits that you guys in swing states like New Hampshire, you see out of a presidential, when a president's in office, you get more No Child Left Behind waivers, you get more disaster declarations, you get more money when you get your disaster declarations, you even get more visits from cabinet members. So right now we have a system that is routinely benefiting the same 5 to 12 states that are battleground states each and every election. We see a system that benefits those states from the point of view of a president serving in office or looking to be reelected or looking to have his or her party carry on after he's out of office. We have a system that hugely benefits the small number of battleground states just because they could go either way. And at the same time, the winner-take-all system effectively shuts out a great majority of the states. 35 to 40 states routinely are completely taken for granted in the process, and that's why a lot of us are pushing for a national popular vote, treat every vote equally, and guarantee the president gets the most votes in the country.
Well, and Chris Pearson, we will talk in just a minute after the break about this national popular vote movement that is getting more attention. Lots of comments from our listeners on Twitter this morning. Alex on Twitter says, we don't elect governors by the method Manchester, Nashua, Concord, and Portsmouth get less say. Alex says, one person equals one vote. Joseph on Twitter says, we live in New Hampshire. Our vote would matter less because the issues being discussed would not apply to us. Also, Bruins fan 05 on Twitter says, this is just an issue because the Democrats lost. He says, get over the loss and start acting like adults. And on Twitter also, Scott says, let's go with the popular vote. 2 times in 16 years, the Electoral College has failed us. What do we have to lose by going with the popular vote? Thanks for those comments. More of your thoughts in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the debate over the Electoral College, why we elect our presidents this way, and whether it's the best way to do so. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. We have three guests to talk about this. Lara Brown, she's at George Washington University in D.C. Chris Pearson, a Vermont State Senator-elect, and also on the board of a movement called National Popular Vote. Also with us, Andy Smith, an associate professor of practice in political science at UNH, director of the UNH Survey Center. And all of you, lots of comments from our listeners. And Andy, I want to throw this one to you because it relates to what we were talking about a moment ago. Tom in Exeter says, what if all the Electoral College delegates were distributed proportionally by state? As an example, New Hampshire has four Electoral College votes. If 55% of New Hampshire went to the Democrat, their nominee would get two, and the Republican would get two votes. I'm wondering what the pros and cons are to this idea. Thank you, Tom, for the thought. And Andy, what do you think?
Well, it would certainly change the way campaigns are run. But the states have the ability to make these decisions already on their own. They can choose how they allocate electors from their states. So a lot of what we're complaining about with the national with the way the Electoral College works can be solved by the states just taking some responsibility to do this themselves. The downside of that is that there's always the possibility that you'll have unintended consequences of the outcomes. And also remember that the political parties who control the national government also control the state governments. And if there's one thing that parties fear is change and uncertainty. And any sort of change to the Electoral College system, I think, is something that both parties would be very, very cautious about, because they know how the current system operates. They don't know how a new system would operate, and somebody would figure it out and take advantage of it, maybe to the detriment of their own party. So I think there's always that element of fear. But I'm sure that however it was done, if there is a change, it's going to take a while, several election cycles, for us to kind of settle into it and figure out how it would work.
Well, and I think Lara mentioned earlier that Maine has gone to this proportional allocation of electors. And our caller, Megan, is in York, Maine. Hi, Megan, go ahead. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Laura. Actually, perfect transition in that it's something that Maine's done the past few elections, and this is the first time that Maine has actually split its electoral votes. Mind you, I was proudly from the blue part, so it wasn't beautiful to see from my end. But it's something that I think if more states adopted, we would start to see a resolution to this debate. I understand and I completely and utterly support the idea of a popular vote. However, clearly there are a lot of people in this country that feel differently. From my view, what happens is that you see the counter argument there of people saying, well, then New York and California would simply decide every election. First of all, I don't necessarily agree with that because they're not monolithic states where everybody votes the same way. But that being said, you as Mr. Pearson's pointed out, you have the exact same problem from the other side of the coin, where you have just a handful of states where the majority of the attention is focused in an election. This is no different. It's just marginalizing different people. And so if more states adopted Maine and Nebraska's system, where you had this the electoral votes being, with the exception of the two senatorial votes, being distributed by congressional district, I think that seems like a really ideal compromise.
Well, Megan, thank you for calling, and good to hear from you, especially since we were talking about Maine's change there. What do you think, Lara?
Well, let me just clarify, because it does get a little confusing when we talk about how states can allocate their electors. So the system we were talking about earlier is proportional representation, whereby the popular vote that you got in the state would determine the amount of electors you were awarded. What Maine and Nebraska do is actually what's called by district. As the caller just suggested, each congressional district essentially gives or awards what the congressional district winner is, an elector, and then whoever wins statewide wins those two electors that are awarded for the senators. Now, what is important about that is that what it does is were we to just go to that model, essentially what you would see is something that approximates the House of Representatives, which many people would be very frustrated with because right now the Republicans, given the distribution of their voters and given some of the gerrymandering that has occurred, essentially have a lock at the House of Representatives level. And this is partly where and why a by-district allocation right now is seen as something that is incredibly and inherently unfair. In fact, Pennsylvania looked at doing it just after the 2012 election, and there was a great hue and upcry over that that issue. The one thing I just want to say is that it's important, too, when we talk about the aggregated popular vote, is that for all intents and purposes, it's not meaningful. And what I mean by that is that right now we get that aggregated popular vote number essentially by accident. It is the number that is added together that comes from the candidates' electoral vote strategies. So in other words, right now we have certain campaigns and candidates trying to drive up votes in certain states. They don't necessarily pay attention to some of the other states that are off the map, so to speak, from a battleground perspective. And the problem with that is that were we to change the winner, or I should say the incentive of how one wins, you change what ends up being important. And so the way I usually describe this is imagine you play a basketball game, and at the end of the basketball game, after one team wins, that team, all of a sudden, the loser says, yes, but let's pretend that free throws don't count. If free throws don't count, we would have won the game. Well, the reality is, when you watch basketball, everyone knows that sort of the last 3 minutes of every game is pretty much based around a free throw point strategy. So you cannot essentially take out those points and assume you have the same game.
So, Lara, for people who say, you know, look, if we had a popular vote this time, Hillary Clinton would have won because of the million more popular votes she got. You're saying maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe if we were running a popular campaign, Donald Trump would have tried really hard in Massachusetts and California, or Hillary Clinton would have tried really hard in, you know, Texas and gotten more votes there. So we really have no idea what would
right.
happen.
It's very hard to impute meaning on what happened because what happened was essentially an aggregated accident.
Let's take another call. This is Paul in Milford. Megan, thank you for that one. Paul, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Good. Go ahead, Paul.
Good. I'm pretty much in the middle on these things, 9 out of 10. I voted Republican. I voted Democrat. That's what's going on that year, that 4 years, whatever the fact may be. My concern is, I see these numbers, in these large cities. I think that people have this consensus that, well, we have all these people in these large cities that are voting one way, and you have these people in rural America and in middle America who are voting another way. I don't think that it's fair to people in rural America, to people in rural areas who live a completely different life, to have their vote not count or not heard. And I feel like taking away the Electoral College is going to do just that. I don't 100% think the Electoral College is perfect. I think that we maybe need a tweak somewhere. But I think that going on a straight populist vote, I think it's really going to take voices away from people. That's just my feeling on it, I guess.
Well, Paul, yeah, a lot of people have written about that, so you're definitely not alone. And I wonder what you think, Chris Pearson. You know, we have heard a lot of folks say, wait, if we had a pure national popular vote, you know, rural states, rural concerns would be ignored because candidates would go where the votes are. Now, you're in Vermont, so I wonder what you think.
Sure. Well, I appreciate Paul's question. I actually think that's exactly the reason to go to a popular vote for president, is because so many people in this country today have no voice in the process. They are completely taken for granted. So first of all, a couple points that should be clear. If you take the 50 largest cities in the country, you only get up to about 15% of our population. Okay, so people tend to think that more people live in cities than in the urban centers than they actually do. And about 15% of the country lives in deeply rural America, and most of us live in kind of suburban and exurban places. But the other problem is that this red-blue map that we're so used to looking at, and now we've seen it down to the county level, which is maybe what Paul is thinking about in particular, and the very huge swaths of red county-level maps throughout the country, they betray something. They betray that, you know, between 35 and 49% of those counties are actually Democratic voters. And same with the urban maps. We think of urban areas as being Democrat, but, you know, in many cases, there's upwards of 40% of the voters there are Republican. And so this is a real challenge, and I think the red-blue map that we're getting so used to looking at creates this impression that we're way more divided than we are. If you have a popular vote, a straight-up popular vote, get the most votes, you win the election, one person, one vote, what becomes the goal is margins everywhere, is you're trying to get the most votes you can everywhere. So I mentioned Idaho earlier, a 400,000-vote margin for the Republicans. That will actually mean something to them. In Massachusetts, I'm not sure what the number is, but it's going to be a large margin for Democrats. They will try to make that even bigger because the Republicans are going to be running the table in Texas and Alabama. And so when you make a popular vote system, it's about margins everywhere. And in that way, everyone is engaged. And in a small state like mine in Vermont, you're not going to have the presidential candidates campaigning for weeks on end, but you are going to have people like me as I go door to door in a legislative race. Right now, I don't even talk about presidential elections. We gave Obama the highest percentage of any state in the country in terms of our results. You could not get an Obama lawn sign if you went down to Democratic Party headquarters. Over in New Hampshire, I'm pretty sure they were begging people to take them, right?
So
this is how shut out we are. A popular vote just makes it about margins everywhere and engages everybody.
So let's go there, Chris. So you have said that, you know, okay, it'd be really tough to get rid of the Electoral College. It's in the Constitution and so on and so forth. So you've got this alternative reform proposal called National Popular Vote, which does not get rid of the Electoral College. So just explain how it works in really clear language with not too many numbers.
I'll do my best. So we've talked about it today. The states have total power over their own electors. In Maine and Nebraska use the district system. The rest of us use winner-take-all. Under the winner-take-all rule, to get the 4 votes out of New Hampshire, you've got to get the most votes in New Hampshire. Under national popular vote, to get the 4 votes out of New Hampshire, you would have to get the most popular votes in the country if New Hampshire passed our bill. Now, New Hampshire wouldn't want to do that on their own. So there's a trigger in our bill that says the whole thing does not take effect until enough other states have also passed it that together those states hold a majority of the electors. They have together 270 electors. So think of it as we're building a pool. Our bill has already passed in 11 states. Those states hold 165 electors. Nothing changes in those states until more states come on board so that we get to 270. When we get that trigger, when we reach that threshold, the law takes effect, and you run a campaign, you add up the votes, the popular votes in all 50 states, and whoever gets the most votes is going to be guaranteed this block of 270 electors, a majority, and therefore they're going to be guaranteed to go to the White House. And along the way, we make every vote equal. Most of us think one person, one vote has something to it. We make every vote matter in every state, in every presidential election. This is the one that really matters to me. And we guarantee the candidate that gets the most votes wins the election.
So it sounds complicated, Chris, and I've looked into it, so I think I understand what you're talking about. But would Congress have to agree to this? Would this be challenged in court where people would say, no, this goes against the Constitution?
Well, a lot of things get challenged in court. There's no great argument that says this is unconstitutional because the Constitution just says, states, you get some electors, it's up to you what to do with them. I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what the Constitution says. So the question of whether or not Congress will have to approve, our bill is te- technically what's known as an interstate compact. And there are hundreds of interstate compacts, and they are contracts between states. The Constitution says that when states enter contracts, Congress has to agree. But the case law for 125 years has been very clear that Congress plays no role in interstate compacts that don't impinge on federal powers. And because our agreement is exclusively a state power, we don't believe that Congress would have to play any role. Now, I should say, if we had to go to Congress to get approval of this, that's not an unimaginable task, because by the time we have passed the states, enough states that they hold a majority of the electors, well, that jives with a majority of members of Congress, right? So those members of Congress would have to be deciding on something that 3 out of 4 Americans supports already today, a popular vote for president, and a majority of the members of Congress would be coming from states that have also agreed with the national popular vote bill. So I don't think that would be an insurmountable challenge. But we believe the case law is pretty clear. Congress doesn't need to play a role.
So, and Chris, I got to jump in. I want to get the other guests in on this. But real quick, from what I understand, the 11 states so far that have jumped onto this are all so-called blue Democratic states. So how do you get the red states to say, yeah, okay, this is a good idea?
We've actually seen last year, you're right, that the early adopter states were blue states, although the New York Senate is a red chamber that led to enactment. A year ago, the Oklahoma Senate passed our bill. In February, the Arizona House passed our bill. These are deep red states. In fact, in 2016, the sponsors around the country of our bill in different states, we had 154 Republicans sponsor our bill and 162 Democrats sponsor our bill. So we are seeing an increasing interest from Republicans who recognize it doesn't make sense to have a presidential campaign basically run in 10 states or less.
Well, and Andy, to you real quick, let's just hit the nail on the head. I mean, the Democrats are feeling like the Electoral College doesn't work for them, given that twice in the last 16 years they've lost the White House despite receiving more popular votes. And Lara already explained how, if we had a popular vote system, those vote totals might be different. But what do you think? In general, Andy, are Democrats the ones who want the system to go and Republicans are saying, no, this is working for us?
Yeah, currently that's the case. But, there's no reason to think that might not change should electoral fortunes of the parties change in the future. Again, the thing that still keeps gnawing at me with this is that we've changed our thoughts about the presidency over the last 200 plus years to the point now where we've forgotten the reason that the framers put in the Electoral College, and that is to try to reduce corruption and make sure that somebody who was beyond reproach would be chosen as president. And they didn't think that the public was capable of doing that, knowledgeable enough or capable enough. And if you look at polling data about what Americans know about politics and government, the framers may have a point.
Well, and coming up, a couple listeners have sent us emails and tweets just saying, can you tell us who these electors are? Also, Lara Brown, I know you've got a reform proposal to put out there. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, reconsidering the Electoral College. Some say it's a vital feature of federalism. Others say it's just plain undemocratic. Let's hear what you think. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook and Twitter at NHPR. Exchange. And Lara Brown, Chris Pearson, Andy Smith, tons of commentary from our listeners today. Here's a couple similar questions that I'll share with you. Scott in Dover says, like many Americans, I was puzzled by the outcome of the election because it seemed Hillary won the popular vote, yet how could she still lose the election? Scott says, so I like the idea of one person, one vote for that reason. But Scott says, please explain to me how the electors are chosen. Is it random? And then Anne also sent us an email, similar question. She says, who are the electors in New Hampshire? When and how are they chosen? Do all U.S. electors actually meet and vote? Why are human electors needed? So thank you to Anne and Scott. And Lara, can you just remind us, who are these people?
Sure. Generally speaking, they are party loyalists. What we really have here is that the Constitution prevents them from being any person who is holding an office of trust or profit under the federal government. But it is typical that they are local mayors, you know, state legislators, sometimes governors, but also just party faithful within the state. And typically, these procedures are essentially done by the parties themselves. So the parties either work with the presidential nominee, or there is a process by which electors are, in fact, chosen in the primary process. It really varies by state. But generally speaking, you know, if you have four electors in New Hampshire, prior to Election Day in November, there were four Republicans who were named electors by their party. There were four Democrats who were named electors. The vote on November 8th determined the fact that the four Democratic electors would go and meet in the state capitol, and they meet in December. They then actually cast their ballots, and then they send them to Congress.
Well, and I have to ask you this, Lara. Lots of chatter over the weekend about so-called faithless electors, since you mentioned the word faith, and whether people could go to their state capitals in Montpelier or Concord or wherever and not vote for the person who won the popular vote. So in Vermont, that would be Hillary Clinton. Last time we saw a debate about this, yeah, it was 2000. I mean, can electors decide once they get to the state capitol?
Well, so that's an actual interesting question. Because of who these people are and how they are chosen, they are essentially bound and committed at a loyalty level to their party's nominee. It is highly unlikely that they will essentially defect or be a faithless elector. In other words, say if they are supposed to vote for Donald Trump, they might cast a ballot for Ted Cruz. But that has happened. In fact, in 2004, a Kerry elector voted for John Edwards. Obviously, it made no difference whatsoever. But I think what's important for people to understand is even though there are faithless elector laws on many of the books in many of the states, those are untested, and most constitutional scholars believe that they would, in fact, sort of be rejected were it to be constitutionally reviewed, because the Constitution does allow elector to essentially vote their conscience. But they usually don't. They vote their party, because that is essentially how they are chosen and the organization, if you will, that they are committed to.
Well, and Andy, I have to ask you this real quick, and then we'll go back to our listeners. We have so many people who want to jump into our conversation, but there has been a lot of, you know, commentary, activity, emails, Facebook, letters, people approaching these electors and saying, please, please change your vote. What does this say, Andy, about the Electoral College, that twice in recent memory it's gotten to this point where it's so close and so uncertain that some people are doing these last-ditch campaigns to the electors?
Well, it shows how important political campaigns are, and
yeah,
the presidency is, and certainly to the minds of some people. You've got to remember that the people that are making these attempts to change the way the system has been working are a small number of the overall people in this country. Most people really don't pay that much attention to politics or to these campaigns, or they are willing, they're more than willing to go along with whoever won the election. So this is something that you see routinely, even in elections in which you don't have a difference between who wins the popular vote and who wins the electoral vote. There's always attempts to, the one last chance that we have is for a faithless elector to do the patriotic thing and stand up for their country. This happens routinely, but as Lara points out, we just don't see it actually come to fruition. So I think more than anything, this is something for the people in the press and the talking heads to talk about, because it's one more potential possibility, no matter how remote, that they can discuss for a while.
Well, maybe amplified by social media,
yes.
Andy. So, Chris, here's an email from Robin, kind of pushing back on what you said earlier when you were describing your movement, the National Popular Vote. Robin says, one person, one vote is a tidy slogan and a relevant principle for some purposes in defining congressional districts, for instance. But Robin says it is crazy to let a tidy slogan define our governance structure and process. He says having the president elected by the states works well and has worked well for a couple of centuries. Robin says we should be very careful. You can never do just one single thing. Robin, thank you for the email. And Chris, what do you think?
Well, I would admit that it works well for New Hampshire. You know, when New York passed National Popular Vote, one of the talking points that we used working with the Assembly was looking at the data from the 2004 and the 2008 campaigns, where the campaign spent about $34 million in the general election in the fall of those campaigns trying to win the four electors in New Hampshire. The 29 electors in New York were worth about $14,000, as I remember. So there was one event of some kind in New York. You know, this is an indicator of a process that benefits greatly a very small number of swing states, of which New Hampshire happens to be. And we've talked earlier in the program about the small states. You know, there's 13 small states that have three or four electors. Of those 13, New Hampshire is the only one that gets any attention in the presidential election. The rest of the 12 small states, we happen to have about 20 million people, and we have 40 electors. Ohio just happens to have about 20 million people. They only have 20 electors. But in the 2012 election, two-thirds of the whole campaign happened in Ohio.
So how do we get rid of this battleground state problem?
You have to go to a popular vote. National popular vote is the easiest way to do that through action through the states. States have this power. And I would argue that states are the aggrieved party. You have routinely 35 states that play no role in a presidential election, those states should look for a new strategy.
Well, and Laura, I want to get you in on this. You know, the battleground issue, a lot of people, not just Chris, you know, say, whether they're Republican or Democrat, say, look, like 10 states, you know, get to decide the election or less in some years. How would you get around this issue?
Well, let me just say a couple things. One, I agree with Robin completely that there are a lot of things that would change were we to sort of think about doing our elections by a national popular vote or even this national popular vote compact. We should remember that there are a few advantages to the Electoral College, the first of which being that it contains controversies in one state. So if we remember back to 2000, Florida had some issues with how it was, its votes were counted. We were able to essentially contain all of the controversy there. But if we had a national popular vote, well, the difference between Al Gore and George W. Bush was 0.5% of the vote, the total vote. And in most states, that is actually an automatic recount number. So were we to, in fact, all of a sudden have something like that for our popular vote, we would be recounting all 100 million ballots in the United States. And political science will tell you that the law of large numbers suggests that those counts can be widely varied the more times you do them. In other words, a recount isn't a more accurate count. It is just a different one. In addition, I want to say to this battleground issue. The battleground does change. It doesn't seem to change in recent memory, but in fact, if you go back to 1988, California was a battleground state. If you go back to the 1800s, New York was a battleground state for the entire century. In other words, it is really important, I think, to realize that we do have a changing, shifting battleground. I guarantee you in the next election, we're going to see Wisconsin and Michigan be battlegrounds, whereas they weren't really in this one. So the battleground does change. And much further, I know we talked about this red-blue divide, but when you look at the research that has been done that looks at where we are in terms of partisan sorting and how we have all essentially moved to the places where we are surrounded by people with like party ideologies.
Sure, we're sort of self-selecting to live with folks like
us.
Yeah,
I mean, Pew Research actually shows that going into this election, there were fewer than 300 counties in the entire United States that were, in fact, competitive to either party. And what that really means is that's where the presidents would travel. They're not going to go to the entire country because were you to go to the entire country, this election would probably be easily five times more expensive than it is. So you're also inviting much more money into politics when you decide to invite every single state, county, and person.
Well, let's go back to our listeners. Again, lots of people want to jump in. And Steve is in Durham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I was just curious if your guest could – there's been some talk about going back to the original convention, the Constitutional Convention, 1787. And, you know, the founding fathers and their attempts for ratification, of course, they wrote Federalist Papers. And, you know, within the Federalist Papers, they defined a lot of, you know, different details, obviously, to the Constitution. And within that, they defined the Electoral College. And I believe it was Federalist Paper 68, written by Alexander Hamilton, that most poignantly addressed the Electoral College. And I was wondering if your guest could give us some context of Federalist 68 and, you know, this idea of abolishing the Electoral College and going to a popular vote. If in this election, if this is not the election whereby Federalist 68 and, you know, the idea of the Electoral College, if they don't address some of the issues that we have right now within the context of Federalist 68, doesn't the Electoral College, in essence, render itself obsolete?
And wow. Okay. So, Steve, a real civics lesson. Thank you so much. Federalist 68, Andy Smith, can I throw that on you? Or
sure. Federalist 68 was the place that I read a quote from earlier about that the manner of election of the chief magistrate is not, be not perfect, is that at least excellent. And in Federalist 68, the things that Hamilton is talking about there really focus on the need to have the president be selected by people who are highly informed about the concerns of the country, the politics of the country, the character of the people who are potential leaders for the country, and that this is something that needs to be done at this high level to kind of reduce the influence of the public, frankly. And if we were to live up to what Hamilton is talking about in Federalist 68, then the current system would be even less democratic than it is. So it's a matter of it's a matter of the fact that we have political parties now, I think, that we didn't have back when the Federalist Papers were written, and that's really hijacked the system. But political parties will take advantage of any sort of rule structure that's out there. I don't think that Federalist 68 necessarily applies today simply because what the parties have done really makes moot many of the arguments here, because that's just not the way the system is working.
Well, and here's an email that came in from Cammie that kind of points out the point that you keep pointing out, Christopher Pearson, as you question whether the presidential vote of people who live in blue states, you know, matters if their state in general trends red. Cammie says, my husband was an engineer, and when he was laid off during the manufacturing slowdown, there were jobs in some red states, but we didn't want to move there. Our blue vote would not have counted. My husband switched careers instead. Then Cammie says, my daughter, a computer science major, only looked for colleges in blue states. Popular vote, Cammie says, would create a country where people could move and be sure at least that their presidential vote would count. Now, real quick, Chris, what do you think of this?
Well, I think Cammie and her family are particularly dedicated to this concept. I'd be surprised if other people are that dedicated to it. But it, you know, my point is this. We should have robust elections. We face enormous challenges in this country, and we should have a vigorous debate where we bring everybody we can to the polls to make decisions. And right now, we're not doing that. We're having vigorous debates in 10 to 12 states. In those states, you see about a 10% increase in voter participation compared to the rest of us. This has impacts on our presidential election, has impacts on our down-ballot races. If we switch to a popular vote where every vote equals, then you will have a more rigorous, I would argue, healthier debate.
And Chris, I just want to jump in real quick because I do want to give Lara Brown a very short chance to describe her idea, a ranked system, Laura. Now, we're coming close to the end of the show. I do apologize, but how would that work?
No, this is, in fact, a proposal that Maine has put forward and has just passed by initiative. It is actually how Maine will use it is that you rank your preferences in terms of your popular vote. So what is in fact very interesting is it allows you to vote. Say there are three people on the ballot, you vote for them as 1, 2, 3. And then what happens is the candidate with the fewest votes actually earns essentially the fewest first place votes. They get essentially eliminated. Their votes are reallocated to the top two. And this happens until somebody gets over 50%.
Wow.
Why that is interesting is I think if we did that at the popular vote level, and then we awarded electors essentially based upon a winner-take-all strategy as we do right now, we would allow for more independence at the sort of beginning level, but then at the same time, more stability at the Electoral College vote level.
Okay. Well, sounds like another conversation because that's real interesting. Lara, thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Lara Brown, associate professor and interim director at the Graduate School of Political Management at GW in D.C. Chris Pearson, it was good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chris Pearson, he's a Vermont State Senator-elect and on the board of National Popular Vote. Andy Smith, thank you as always.
Great to be here, Lara.
Andy Smith, associate professor of practice in UNH and director of the UNH Survey Center. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.